Okay, the next item is a information item on the Klamath National Forest, KNF, West Side Fire Recovery Project. Tom Williams will be presenting NKNF staff, and I again wanted to go procedurally. What we have determined is that the executive director has authority to send it to a board hearing. The chairman has it on call, and the board can do so as well. Because this is only noticed as an informational item, we can't take a vote, but board members can express sentiment.
Chairman Corbett, board members, members of the public, my name is Tom Williams. I'm an engineering geologist in the Northern Nonpoint Source and Forestry Unit. I'm also the staff liaison between the Regional Water Board and Klamath National Forest. Item number four is an informational item by the Klamath National Forest on the West Side Fire Recovery Project. The West Side Fire Recovery Project encompasses three fire complexes, the Happy Camp, Whites, and Beaver fires that burned about 162,300 acres of Klamath National Forest lands in the late summer of 2014. The West Side Project is designed to address needs for one, worker and public safety and access, two, safe conditions for firefighters performing fire suppression for community protection, three, a project that is economically viable, meeting project objectives and benefiting local communities, and four, restored and fire-resilient forested ecosystems. Klamath National Forest proposes to accomplish this by conducting timber salvage operations, hazard tree removal, fuel treatments, reforestation, and sediment legacy site treatment. Patricia Grantham, the forest supervisor for the Klamath National Forest, is here to give a presentation on the West Side Fire Recovery Project. So I'll have Patricia come up and give her presentation.
And Patricia, because this is going on the mics, you need to put say your name over again. So.
So good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. My name is Patty Grantham. I'm the forest supervisor of the Klamath National Forest and the Butte Valley National Grasslands, located a little bit not so far east as the crow flies, but when you got to drive here, it's a ways. I'm joined here by Dan Blessing, who's my natural resources staff officer, and hopefully we can cover this and answer any questions you may have today. I've had the opportunity to do a number of presentations on the West Side Fire Recovery Project, as you may well imagine, and I always sneak this slide in no matter what I'm doing because it captures two forms of technology that are pretty effective for us out there. Oh, there we go. That's what I need, that kind of technology. Okay. So just as a little bit of an overview, 2014 Klamath large fire activity. There's a little map of what we dealt with this year. Unfortunately, our neighbors on the Six Rivers and Shasta T are dealing with something similar this year. I'm not so sad to not be in that mix quite yet. Again, as you can say, for the West Side Fire Recovery Project, we're dealing with that Whites Fire area, the Happy Camp Complex, and the Beaver Fire. That Oregon Gulch is just on there. Kind of a little bit more for context, that was a CAL FIRE and Oregon Department of Forestry fire. It burned a little bit. You can see a little bit of green underneath that fire-shaded area. And then the Little Deer Fire on our east side, it was dealt with a different restoration analysis and document. So overwhelmingly, to the tune of about two-thirds, the fire that we experienced in 2014 looked like this. It was a low-severity fire, cleaned out the understory. What was a good thing? What was a good thing? Here's a little photo of a little more fire intensity. You can kind of see some high severity in the middle of that. patch, and then you know, along the edges you can see some mixed severity going. Mixed severity on this fire, or rather moderate severity on this fire, you know, quite unusual, accounted only for about 6% of the total acres burned. So in 2014, again, I suspect when we were driving over here, we saw the Jerusalem fire kicking up yesterday afternoon. I suspect everybody saw that. Kind of looked a little something like this. You know, we just had multiple extreme burning days in 2014. You know, again, 3 years of drought. Now we're 4 years of drought. 3 years of drought, you know, record-setting temperatures, average daily maximum temperatures in July. Actually, we crushed the previous records in the community of Wairika and in Happy Camp. Dry conditions and, of course, fire starts. You know, we inherited fire conditions that look like this. So about 27% of the West Side fire area burned with high intensity, high severity. And this is what it looks like. You know, thousands of acres of this kind of burned landscape. So this is a severity map based on tree basal area loss. And it's unusual in that really there's only two colors that stand out there. And the colors are that bluish color, which is the, you know, low severity fire, and the red, which is high severity fire. That's pretty unusual for us, I would say. I've been on the Klamath for 8 years, so this is not scientific, but my fire ecologist tells me that I'm in the ballpark when I say that, you know, our typical high severity, you know, kind of fires, the proportion in our fires should be about 10 to 12%, or normally are about 10 to 12%. So this is an old slide that I failed to remove and give the new slide, but I just, it's still useful because, is there a pointer on here? Would I know where it was? Is it the top button? Okay. I'm going to go back for a minute. Come on. One right below the top. There we go. I'm going to go back again. So, I have a fat thumb. This is the community of Syad Valley right here. This is the Klamath River, Highway 96. This is the community of Happy Camp right here. So, kind of... and the Scott River is right there. That was the eastern fire line there. When we took a look at you know, potential salvage operations, you know, we've really homed in on those high severity areas, and so really that's what this this slide is instructive for. Because again, so here's Syad Valley right here, and you can kind of see, you know, this piece in here, and if I go back, you can kind of see how it aligns, or Syed Valley, you can kind of see how it aligns with the high severity fire. And you know, and ultimately when we take a look at our treatments, you know, a big objective is to not have something, or do our best to reduce in areas so that we can reduce the amount of this that we're going to be dealing with in 15 or 20 years. A lot of dead fuels, brush coming up, a lot of dead fuels on the ground, a lot of standing snags, which will, of course, create, perpetuate high-intensity fire on the landscape. I think Tom talked a little bit about what our project objectives are, so... you know, they're about reducing hazards out there, both to the public and to forest workers. You know, a big piece is creating safer conditions for firefighters to get out there and do their job. Having an economically viable project that will meet the community objectives and benefits of local communities, because, you know, salvage is a very valuable tool that's going to help us meet these objectives that are out there. And then, of course, restoring and... making the forested ecosystems more fire resilient. And these objectives really kind of they don't so much overlap as they're sort of interlocking in some regards, and I think I'm going to cover that a little more later. Your staff did a review of our draft environmental impact statement. At that time, our preferred alternative was alternative 2. We are at the point now, of course, we just issued a final environmental impact statement. It just became available last Friday. And our preferred alternative at this time is a modified alternative 3. And in kind of rough terms, the amount of salvage and the roadside treatments they're about half of what they were originally proposed. And the acres of reforestation has come down too. All those modifications were a result of a whole bunch of different things coalescing, public comment, concerns raised by the water board staff, working with the different tribes and the different, other agencies in terms of our consultation obligations. So this is a slide of salvage harvest. It's just to kind of orient you. I'm sure you've seen this before, but, so treatments after harvest and before fuel treatments are completed, because of course we do the harvest piece, then we do the post-activity fuel treatment. There's a little picture of some roadside hazard. You can kind of clearly see the hazards that are going to exist there soon. In fact, I've got people out there right now. We have trees coming down now along those roadways. WUI treatments. Adjacent to communities, we've proposed to treat, the forest in those areas. When you take a look at our proposal, your eyebrows may raise a little bit because there's not necessarily a lot of acres there, but during fire suppression operations, a lot of those acres were accomplished because they were getting those areas ready for the fire to come in. But there's still some areas to go, and that's what they would look like. Another key piece of what we're proposing to do is to do reforestation out there for, multiple purposes. We want to get the forest reestablished. We think that in terms of sedimentation, water quality concerns, I think that getting trees in the ground, getting them reestablished as soon as possible is a real positive thing. Here's just a little pie chart that's exploded that talks a little bit about, kind of puts the project into some degree of perspective. We have fuel breaks and underburns planned for about 15% of the project area. Again, roadside hazard. About half of the roads, are going to be treated, and in a lot of places that's kind of that's also very sporadic. It's kind of a hit and miss thing, because we're only removing along roadsides. We're only removing those fire affected dead and dying trees. Salvage site prep and planting planned for about 3.5% of the fire area, and it's about 11% of the total high fire intensity areas. I talked a little bit about the interlocking nature of some of these treatments, and really when you look at the fuel breaks and you look at the salvage piece, and they work in concert with each other in order to break up the landscape so that we have an effective strategy in the big picture to not only have some opportunities in the future to have some prescribed fire in those areas, and also opportunities in the future potentially to allow natural fire, to burn in those areas. But also to effectively be able to segment, fire as it returns in the future, and, keep it from affecting, 200,000 acres out there on the landscape just because of severity and extreme conditions. And, we think that our overall fuel strategy, that salvage and fuel breaks in concert with each other, is going to be able to segment things and be able to kind of, you know, keep them contained to smaller areas on the landscape. And then we have site prep and planting plan for about 4.5% of the fire area. And, you know, that includes 14% of the high severity fire area. That's without any salvage. So there's two different kinds of planting that are happening out there. I'm going to let Dan talk a little bit about this piece.
These are, this is the watershed effects models that we use. My name's Dan Blessing. I'm the natural resource officer for the Klamath National Forest, and I appreciate you having us back again, you know, to do this presentation. The cumulative watershed effects model I'm going to talk about a little bit here is actually a suite of three different types of models. One is the ERA model, which measures, you know, the disturbance at a watershed scale, and the USLE model, which measures, you know, soil erosion, actual, you know, sheet erosion coming off the soil, and the GEO, which is the one that measures, you know, the potential for landslides. And so the types of ground disturbing activities and other types of events that are put into this model are listed here, you know, the vegetation removal, timber harvest, thinning, you know, hand thinning, fuels reduction, any sort of temporary road use, creation of temporary roads, landing construction, or if we make those, you know, log landings a little larger, we put that in the model. We actually model the effects of the, in this case, the wildfire that went before and all the suppression activities. So, you know, hand lines, dozer lines, those types of, you know, ground disturbing activities are in the model. Prescribed birding, you know, post treatment, prescribed burns. And then anything that, you know, would be, you know, kind of on the plus side, beneficial type things that would, you know, be kind of a opposite of what, you know, these other ground disturbing activities would be road improvements. So if we get in there, you know, we do, in case of this fire, we did some bare work, you know, so we did some road outsloping and rocking and put in some rolling dips, those types of things. So that's part of the things that would counter the other stuff. And then the road decommissioning, which is not part of this project. So the findings here are that, you know, the increase in risk is really associated, you know, overwhelmingly associated with, you know, the fire activity that happened out there. That there's also increase in peak flow, and that sort of addresses the question a little bit before, you know, what's the immediate, what happens, you know, due to the fire actions? Is there more flow? Yeah, that's that peak flow part of it. Having more water available is great, but, you know, it's also the timing of, you know, when that water happens. That, you know, we're also saying that the bare treatments out there were designed to reduce the fire effects, you know, so we've got those in place. They're almost complete. You know, we had several contracts that were put in place. That, you know, the reforestation, the model shows that it will help recover and stabilize soils, both, you know, for the soil loss and for the deep-seated road, landscape danger. And the fuel treatments will mitigate against future high-intensity fire. And that we do have road effects, and they're mostly at the site scale. So what are some of the outputs of those models? You know, it shows The top one is the landslide model, that one that was called GEO originally. And so the fire effects in Lower Grider Creek here show that 139% increase due to the fire of landslide risk. The effects of our action is going to add another 2.3% in the Lower Grider Creek to that. And so then we also modeled out what would happen in a fire in 2034, so 15 years, you know, post-fire, excuse me, 20 years post-fire, I can't do math. We modeled both with, you know, with the treatments, the modified alternative three treatments, and without those treatments. And so what you have here is the difference. So if you had a fire in 20 years from the original fire, what would be the effects of that? And we modeled that for landslides. And there's a 48% reduction in landslide risk if we do these treatments. And that has to do with, you know, doing the fuel treatment out there and, you know, getting it in a better condition for future fires, and also reforestation, you know, putting trees on the site, because as you saw, those earlier photos showed that there's areas out there that it's going to be a really long time before, you know, we get these things seeding in. So that's the landslide model. There's four of them here that I just gave as an example, but we have the full report that we can give you. Also, for the soil loss model, that's that overland flow. Again, with Lower Grider Creek, fire effects, 122% increase in, you know, sheet erosion. We would be adding about a 2.3 addition there, but the reduction due to those treatments after a, you know, model fire is a 205% reduction compared to, you know, not doing anything at all. All right, so that means that the future fire would be lower in intensity, and so you would have less soil loss at that point. So just to talk a little bit about the draft waiver and, you know, what we've done to address, you know, the waiver. These are some of the design features that we put in for roads in particular. So no new system roads. The new temporary roads will avoid any riparian reserves. No temporary roads or landings on active landslides, tow zones, or intergorges. Temporary roads that are reopened and decommissioned roads will have culverts and fills removed and the road slopes restored to the original condition, or most likely in a better condition than they were. And then we're going to cover the roads with temporary roads with slash or straw or whatever in any hydraulically connected segments. So also within the riparian areas, we're not cutting live vegetation. We're not using equipment within the riparian reserves except for, you know, where a road crosses that riparian reserve. It'll be on the road surface only. And, you know, we're restricting equipment on slopes, and making sure there's cover on skid trails. And then these are the design features for fuels, you know, as they relate to the prescribed burning in the hand piles and burning the hand piles. And just, you know, to mention the different, you know, activities, these are, you know, the reforestation. It's going to decrease the time needed to establish a forest on these areas. We also modeled that, you know, both with treatment and without treatment. And, you know, what we found is those areas that are a long way from the nearest seed source with in a fire ecosystem could take up to 200 years, you know, to put a closed canopy forest with 20-inch trees in place. And with these treatments, we expect to get those same areas reforested in 70 years. So it's really advancing the time necessary. And as you probably know, most of this area is Lake Sessional habitat. So we really want to, you know, have a forested habitat on there again. And these treatments, these reforestation, these salvage, these field treatments are designed to do that a lot quicker than without. This shows that, you know, our bear work, we repaired 175 legacy sites. We actually put in over 400 rolling dips, and we've replaced a couple of culverts. Not all of those were legacy sites originally, but they're just designed, all of them were designed to help the road function better. But it did address, you know, 175 legacy sites that were previously identified or identified as part of this project. And also it shows that here, you know, this is on the left side here, shows a road that was, we put the rolling dip in, we armored that with rock. We had, you know, some of these microbursts happen during, you know, just a few weeks ago. And so these things actually functioned as they were designed. You know, they channeled that stuff across the road. The road did not, you know, channel that water down the road and, you know, or didn't destroy the road, start, you know, causing additional sediment from the road to happen. You know, they're designed to pass these things through, these you know, well-predicted storm events and, you know, the associated soil loss that you know, we said was going to happen in those models and stuff that, you know, we know that's going to happen. We would just want to make sure that these roads don't add to that they pass these things through. So this talks about the legacy site treatment plan. This is part of our waiver application. These are, you know, Carolyn showed this before. These are the four watershed condition framework watershed that the Klamath has identified in the different TMDLs and the legacy sites that we are going to be treating as part of these. So that's the end of our presentation.
Thank you.
I think we will take a break for lunch, and then we have an estimated 15 minutes in executive session that's been requested by a board member, which will be honored. So we should be back in.
Chair?
Yes, I'm sorry.
May I have an alternative proposal? If we could maybe just go through board member questions while it's fresh, would
okay, I have no problem with that. And then after that, we'll follow it by the break.
Great. Thank you. Thanks for the presentation.
And I misinterpreted your hand signal.
That's okay. Don't worry about it. Shouldn't have done anything at all.
I thought you wanted to move quickly to lunch.
I'm gonna let you know we have questions. Great. Thank you. It seems that a lot of the management prescription is based on your CWE modeling. And is that modeling calibrated? So are your inputs calibrated, and do you go out and verify your results?
They have been calibrated by, you know, a couple of things. You know, our hydrologist is here, and he's worked to do that. You know, our quality assurance plan monitoring. You know, he's monitoring all or 79 watersheds within the forest. You know, we have those on a rotating basis and stuff, and so he's really working take all that monitoring information and compare it, you know, to that model and show that there's, you know, that it is a reasonable model. Berkeley also did a study in the Oak Knoll area to also help calibrate that model.
So yeah, I'm curious. I mean, particularly for, you know, field verification, if, you know, it's one thing to, you know, for using a USLE model, you can look on a SCS map and see that it's a Atwell type 2 soil versus going out and checking and see that actually what happened is you have a hydrophobic condition post-fire, and it's particularly in your high-intensity burn areas, which may dramatically affect what your modeling results are going to be. So if I'm curious if, you know, maybe what percentage of an area that you look at that you apply that model over. So we just saw, you know, for this west side area, just an enormous area that had burned. So going in and applying a model to that to say, well, this is what, you know, should be, what my input variables should be. Is this really what we have out on the ground? And then going back afterward, post-modeling and seeing, is the model predicting accurately to, you know, go check 5% of the basin or something like that? Is something like that being done?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. You know, the bear work, you know, we have the bear planning happens right at the end of the fire, right? And so they, you know, they predict what's going to happen, you know, in the next few storms and try to do mitigation measures, you know, to protect those things. So, you know, we talk about, you know, those impacts. You know, we have we do flights over the fire to assess, you know, the soil damage, you know, specifically to the soils. And then we do the mitigation measures, you know, to directly address those based on, you know, the soil types and everything else. And then, you know, right now that we've had those, a few of those events recently, we're going back out and we're putting together reports. And I know that Greg was frantically trying to, you know, send those off to the water board yesterday before we left, but we just hadn't quite tied that up. But, you know, hopefully when we get back, we'll get those to you away.
Yeah, I'd really like to see a copy of that.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
So would I.
Yeah. Thank you.
Other board members?
Yes, thank you. Dan, it's good to see you again. Thank you for coming back. Patty, it's a pleasure to meet you, and thank you for making the effort. I'm sure your plate is full these days. Again, just I wanted to share this with you, Patty, where I'm coming from. But, you know, back in the 90s, I sat on the Northwest Forest Planning Committee for Northern California, and as I shared with Dan in June when he was here, I don't remember a lot of the details of the discussion about late successional areas, matrix lands, or riparian reserves, but I remember the intensity of those. And so to honor the work that went in 20 years ago, as I shared in June, you know, I'm not philosophically opposed to salvage logging. It was a great job both of you did today. I think it was very thoughtful, and you made your point well. For me, the riparian reserves is my focus. And, you know, if you read out of the plan, it talks about only activities that protect or enhance ACS, aquatic conservation strategy, objectives are permissible within a riparian reserve. That's my button. So, you know, what I ask you is to work with Fred and staff and Matt. The harder you can push on that, the more we can focus on protecting and enhancing those riparian reserves. That's my mark. And as I said, you know, I wouldn't have cared if you've been out there cutting trees since June and getting moving. I want this to get moving for the community up there, for your own personal objectives and the like. But, you know, I will react to things like landings and other activities that will support silvicultural operations. I understand why you need those, but how do we meet that basic definition of protection and enhancement? So I'm a simple man. I try and bring things down to what I can understand, and that's where my drive's coming from. But I see tremendous progress. I thank you for listening to us, but I'm going to keep pushing. The better we can be on that front, the better we'll be. All of us will be. So thank you.
Any other board members? I just wanted to echo Board Member Gusti's comments. Same concern.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we will return at 1:30. 10 plus 15, 130.
And John, just to be clear, so we'll return and after executive session take up public comments on this
yes, at 1:30.
Okay, thank
so
you.
So the board has to return faster than 1:30 because we got executive session.
Great, thank you.
Sorry for the miscue on that. What?
Okay, I'm going to have us back in session. It's time for public comment. And I have slips, so I'm going to call up three names. Please be ready in order. Kimberly Baker, Susan Corum, Tom Wheeler.
Good afternoon. Kimberly Baker with the Klamath Forest Alliance and EPIC Environmental Protection Information Center. The Wild and Scenic Rivers, the Klamath, Scott, and Salmon Rivers are all listed under the Clean Water Act. There are 802 miles of tributaries associated with these. It also includes over 100 miles of critical coho habitat. There's also key watersheds in the project area. Modified Alternative 3 proposes nearly 2,000 acres of clear cuts on geologically unstable riparian reserves. And I do call them clear cuts. If you look at the Wildlife Biological Assessment Table G6 on page G54, it lists the units, and this is not a complete list, and the retention patches. For instance, in Walker Creek, which is landslide prone, 571 acres, and the retention patch is only 94 acres, and I'll give you this list. So they are very large areas of complete removal of all the trees. The board has expressed obvious concerns about this logging in riparian reserves. And even the Forest Service application admits that the existing trees will provide slope stability for the crucial years post-fire as natural regeneration revegetates. And science clearly shows that post-fire logging hinders natural regeneration and also slope stability and can even increase the fire risk. The majority of science used in the geology reports are in areas not similar at all to the Klamath Mountains. They come from New Zealand, Australia, and even Japan. The models for the landslide risk only look at trees over 10 inches, and they don't include the brush and the shrubs regrowth. That was what I obtained from the information, the FEIS, and the reports. The treatment of helicopter slash here is really important. A lot of these areas are proposed for helicopter logging, and as we've seen from the salmon salvage that was implemented last year on the North Fork of the Salmon River, while the slides, I have different photos to show you of what helicopter logging slash looks like. The Klamath National Forest is now considering helitorching or aerial igniting some of those units because the slash is so deep that it's nearly impenetrable and impossible to handle manually. And the FEIS does not at all address this. I think that I saw heli-torching somewhere in the fish BA. I'm not sure. So that's definitely something that needs to be clarified because igniting these areas of very deep slash can have significant effects on soils, and especially when you're looking at geologically unstable riparian reserves. Roads. The board has expressed concern over the number of level one roads proposed to be reconstructed. And while the Klamath National Forest has reduced the amount of roads, modified alternative three still proposed to open 34 miles of roads, of level one roads. And some of that is in riparian reserves. However, it's hard to really figure out what's happening in the FEIS and all of the reports to what exactly is happening in the riparian reserves.
And then you'll need to sum up?
Okay. The Klamath National Forest does not talk about the amount of maintenance that it will be required for the level two roads. There's 953 legacy sites in the area. Only 353 are being proposed for treatment. That leaves 600 areas that are not going to be treated. A majority of the logging units are in Walker and Grider Creeks, and I'd like to show you this map. The blue areas are geologically unstable areas, and you can see the large concentration in Grider and Walker Creeks, which are both coho critical habitat.
And can you turn that around so the Forest Service can see that and so they know what you're referring to?
This is the Grider Creek and Walker Creek ranges. So you can see that massive amount, and that is where a majority of the larger units are concentrated. The recent sediment event just happened. I have photographs of one road, 24 different sites.
And then I really do have to have you, I do want to say, because this is an information session, you can send stuff to staff and in writing, and that can go in the final record, and that makes sure your work gets read really carefully.
Thank you. I will, and I hope that you have read what I have provided you already. I just, to finish up, I would just say that this project is so massive in scale, so much in riparian reserves, and so many legacy sites that it does not qualify for the waiver, and that I hope that you would work to require strict requirements in a waste discharge requirement permit. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Susan Corm.
Good afternoon, Board. This is Susan Corm with the Creek Tribe. The application for coverage of West Side under the existing waiver does not adequately address the concerns that your staff wrote a letter to Klamath National Forest on April 27th, 2015, and they have not been addressed adequately. West Side is not a project that will be mitigable to less than significant levels for water quality impacts. For example, what Kimberly already said, there's still 34.4 miles of level one roads that they want to work on. What the waiver primarily does to protect water quality, as you guys all know, you protect riparian, number one, number two, you treat legacy sites, number three, use BMPs. So I pulled my information out of the application that was sent to you by Klamath National Forest staff. For protecting riparian, which you'd think that would be staying out of the riparian, for example, Grider is a critical coho habitat and tier one watershed for salmon recovery, yet there is logging that's going to be occurring in there. Within riparian reserves, there's 1,973 acres that they're logging within geological riparian reserves. It's almost 2,000 acres within the riparian. You were talking about logging decks earlier. That was a concern. There's six new logging decks, three existing logging decks for a total of nine logging decks within riparian reserves. This is just within riparian reserves again. They want to open up 4.8 miles of level one roads. They want to reopen 1.2 miles of previously decommissioned roads. They want to reopen 0.2 miles of existing temporary roads and build 0.1 miles of near temporary roads. That sounds like a lot of road work. That's 6.3 miles just within riparian reserves. There's also going to be 39 road stream crossings. And as far as treating legacy sites, I did hear work that there's being done for bear, but you saw earlier that the legacy sites that are being treated are Syad, Sugar, Elk, and White. Before West Side came up, Sugar, Syad, and Elk were already on the list. The only thing that's been new for this huge project they want to do that's been added is White's Gulch. There's nothing new that's been added within Syad, Grider, Walker. Grider, Walker, Beaver, places that we saw when we had these big debris torrents this year that kind of blew open. We do, White's is going to be a good project, though. We're on board with that one. The increase in cumulative impacts will not be offset by controlling legacy sediment sources due to significant impacts of road systems, 100 years of forestry mismanagement, fire suppression, and then catastrophic fire. For example, you can see what happened. One of our big concerns is this has reset the baseline now. We haven't even had an El Nino year yet. They haven't started salvage logging yet. This was a couple little storm bursts that you can see. No Name Creek right here. This was July 11th. I think this was like a 45-minute burst or so. This is a tributary to Walker Creek, and then here's Walker Creek. You can see we're having huge debris torrents. We're having culvert failures. This is the North Fork of the Salmon. This was coming. The sediment that you can see was coming from North Russian Creek, North Fork Russian Creek, and Music Creek up the North Fork. And then you can see here's the Klamath River closer to the mouth. And this sediment that you can see in here was coming from your mid-Klamath debris flows. This was coming from Walker, Grider, Beaver, all the places, all these little tributaries right there where they're not doing legacy site treatment. This is where the sediment was coming from. And this was just one little flush. Okay, I can see I'm out of time, so I'm going to wrap up now for Mr. Corbett before he has to tell me. So as far for using BMPs, I said earlier today that they're not suited for these catastrophic conditions. And again, I think we have a new baseline condition. I think the final EIS should have to do new baseline assessment. We're concerned about modeling and stuff. Tell me what this does to the models. And so what I would say is West Side should not be unrolled under the existing waiver. This decision should be remanded to the board if need be, or the executive officer, however you need to make the decision for the wording you were talking about earlier, and should be dealt with at the October board meeting. And the Klamath National Forest should have to file a report of waste discharge to deal with all these issues for this project. Thank you very much. Have a good afternoon.
All right, thank you.
And would you like to me to leave this for the staff?
Yes.
Okay.
And Tom Wheeler, Epic. Then I want to have on deck Felice Pace, and then George Harper.
Good afternoon. My name is Tom Wheeler. I'm a staff attorney with the Environmental Protection Information Center, or EPIC. EPIC has been tracking the development of the Westside project since scoping was initiated in October 2014. Since then, we have remained concerned about the project's impact on water quality. We do not believe that the Westside project falls within the waiver, which is reserved for projects which will not cause significant impact to water quality. On April 27th, 2015, Executive Officer Matt St. John sent a letter to the Klamath National Forest raising water quality concerns he had after reviewing the draft environmental impact statement. Since Mr. St. John's letter, the Forest Service has revised the project to reduce impacts to water quality, but many of these concerns are still there. First, the project doesn't follow the aquatic conservation strategy of the Northwest Forest Plan. Within the application packet, you have supporting document number 3, proposed changes for treatments and riparian reserves. According to the tables provided by the Forest Service to the Water Board, they say that they are not going to salvage log in riparian reserves. This is not true. The project proposes clear-cut style logging on 1,973 acres of geologically unstable slopes, which are consistent with riparian reserves. The Forest Service justifies this logging in two ways. It says that the trees will have removal of the trees will have an immeasurable impact on sediment because their root structure is decaying and will not provide sufficient support in the future. But that ignores the fact that this root structure, which is decaying and eventually will not provide soil support, is providing soil support now. And so if a 45-minute rain event created that sort of a sediment impact, I wonder what sort of sediment events we're going to have this winter with an El Nino winter on a clear cut about 2,000 acres in size. Second, the Forest Service's logging is based on an assumption that regeneration will not occur naturally, that they need to go in and log, and only through logging can they replant. And this is a false assumption. There's no requirement for them to go in and cut trees so that they can replant. They are going to replant in other areas which they are not going to cut. It's just not true that they need to go in and do this. Second, Mr. St. John expressed concern over reopening 69 miles of roads categorized as level 1, which are typically closed. As Susan and Kimberly pointed out before, the Forest Service now proposes 34 miles of either new or reopened level 1 roads. While a reduction in the total number of roads, the Forest Service does not address the underlying concern raised with reopening roads. What's more, the Forest Service proposes 6 new landings within riparian reserves, which it admits will negatively impact water quality. So I see my time is up. EPIC requests 2 things. First, we want the board to ultimately make the decision on whether or not this falls within the waiver. And this, to be clear, is not a reflection of our belief on the staff and their capabilities or capacities, but rather because of the controversy of the project and the large size, we think that it's appropriate for the board to take on this decision. Second, we ask that the board deny enrollment to the Westside project underneath the waiver and require the Forest Service to seek a WDR permit. Thanks.
you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Tom, quick question for you. Both you and Kimberly cited geologically unstable slopes, and the map that Kimberly showed a very large area that was unstable. Do you have a citation for that, or if you don't know it off the top of your head, can you provide it in your written comments, please?
Yeah. Kimberly's map was obtained from the Forest Service. They admit in Ms. Grantham's letter back to Mount St. John, she discusses and says that they will log within these unstable areas. And I could get you a reference to the Northwest Forest Plan, which says, or the Klamath National Forest Long-Range Management Plan, which says that these types of areas are within riparian reserves.
Sure, yeah, I've seen that. I didn't know if you had additional information from published mapping.
No, I don't.
Okay,
thank you.
Thanks.
Is Felice Pace present? I'm going to put him at the bottom of the pile if he isn't. Next up, George Harper, and after that, William Deere, and then after that, Felice Pace.
My name is George Harper. I really appreciate the opportunity to come before you folks and air my opinions. I live in Happy Camp, California, a little ways up Elk Creek out of town, about a mile. I was intimately familiar with the fire this year because it burned about from me to you from our back door. I'm now retired, but my working career has been with the Forest Service of about 35 years, the last 20 of which was the district ranger at Happy Camp. I was there for the 1987 fire event, which was kind of similar and kind of different from the 2014 event. But in 1987, Happy Camp District had about 150,000 acres inside a fire perimeter somewhere on the Ranger District. Given the those times, which were obviously different, we salvaged around 150 million board feet off of those acres and reforested something in excess of 10,000 acres, planted almost 4 million trees. I've got to live there and watch the countryside after that event and those follow-up actions. With that sort of experience base, I see the West Side Fire Recovery Project as a pretty a relatively mild proposal to deal with the number of burned acres that exist in the Happy Camp, particularly in the Happy Camp complex. I think the tables that Patty and Dan showed that gave a relationship between the watershed effects of the fire plus the anticipated watershed effects of the recovery effort and compared that to an estimate of what the watershed effects might be without the recovery at a future point in time when the next generation of fire or two occurs. I would not attempt to defend the absolute accuracy of those numbers, but I think the relationship of playing what if we do it and what if we don't and what are the future effects. My experience has been those numbers reflect pretty well, I think, what my experience would indicate would be real life. And part of that I'm basing on, since 1987, quite a few of those acres that we treated have burned again or been in a fire again. And not in all cases did those treatments prevent severe damage from the next round of fire. but in quite a, in the bulk of the cases, I believe it did. So I would encourage the board, I guess, to be without compromising your principles and your beliefs and so on. I would encourage the board to be supportive of the recovery effort. I think that the long-term effects of the recovery effort will definitely be beneficial, and in my view, it would be really scary if we scale that project way back from what it is.
I need you to finish up.
I don't believe that would be a wise thing to do from a land management standpoint. Thank you.
May I ask a question? Yes. Just George, thank you. Thank you for making the drive, and thank you for your comments. Following the 1987 incident and the trees that you went back and planted, were you able to go back in year 10, year 15, do you know, and do some pre-commercial thinning, some spacing, you know, trying to move those stands to be more fire resistant, to get, just to reduce some biomass, but then also, as we know, bigger trees tend to be more fire hardy. You know, were you able within the scope of your job to have crews going out there and trying to move these stands in that direction?
Yes, most definitely. We had a really major reforestation effort in terms of introducing trees to those burn sites, but in a sense that larger scale program extended into out years. Yes.
And the reason I was asking, I mean, getting trees in the ground is only the first step.
That's
right.
Correct.
And I was wondering if you had the capacity to do the following steps, which are necessary to ensure.
The organization was very supportive of of the idea that, right, that planting was the first step. We had pretty darn decent funding to do follow-up treatments.
Good. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
William Deere?
William A. Durr, and thank you, panel and staff and the other folks for putting up with me the second time today. I'm going to just give a few overview comments, if I may. And listening to all of the very excellent and certainly well-meaning, well-intentioned comments here today, I'm terribly impressed with what everybody had to say. There's no question that we are all looking for the same outcome. The term outcome is kind of interesting because it's a function of relative values and relative outcomes. And I think George here hit the nail on the head. Undoubtedly, whatever is done, whether it's with or without the waiver, ultimately is going to create some additional disruption. But the big question is, in terms of long-term strategic thinking and planning, what will the final outcome be? And I do believe George stated it very well when he gave us the history of what happened in 87 and what subsequently took place. And I believe history does repeat itself, and if the 87 efforts at rehab were successful, then I dare say that the rehab efforts currently, with whatever tweaks are necessary, either as a function of both sides submitting their respective views and the panel's decision, that also will be successful. I would offer, in my own opinion, that a tweaking of the waiver in full consideration of those who are opposed to it may be a better path to follow than not granting the waiver. And I thank you very much for your time.
Felice Pace is... I'm sorry. Are there any questions?
Yes, sir.
Matt St. John, can you restate your last point? Because I think that it was your punchline, and I didn't fully understand. So can you restate your conclusion?
My conclusion is that given the apparent success that was described to us by George Harper following the 87 fires in terms of the restoration rehab work that was done. The panel is now looking at an issue here, whether to grant or not grant the waiver, and whether or not, if they do grant the waiver, to make appropriate modifications to it to the extent that is necessary to satisfy those who are opposed to the waiver. In my humble opinion, going forward with a modified waiver is far superior than not granting the waiver, because time is going by, and if we measure this in terms of what we want the outcome to be 20 years hence, then I do believe that that will be accomplished by taking another look at the waiver, paying close attention to those folks who have raised very legitimate concerns about certain aspects of it, making the necessary modifications. And again, my recommendation is to stay on the waiver path. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Felipe J. Pace.
How much time do I have, Don?
Three.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it. Felipe Pace, speaking for the North Group, Redwood Chapter Sierra Club. The modified alternative does not qualify for enrollment under the permit. None of the alternatives there do. For one thing, they extend high landslide risk 30 years into the future. What's the probability of a large storm in the last 30 years? But the main problem here in terms of the analysis and the presentation is not being honest, because the earth flows we talked about this morning, they create the most nuisance sediment and the largest amounts because of the deep soils. Only the toe zones, which are narrow zones at the bottom, are included as riparian reserves, and therefore they're not in the analysis of landslide risk. And you could read that right there in the geology report. And those officials from the Klamath National Forest that are saying otherwise need to look at that report and admit that the earth flows, only the toe zones are in there. So key watershed, Upper Grider, high landslide risk for 30 years. Cliff Valley, high, also part of Grider, 30 years. Lower Grider, 80 years, greater than 80 years. Upper Elk Creek, moderate for 30 years. Lower Elkfort, moderate for 30 years. These are risks that are going to come home to roost. And establishing plantations, how many thousands of acres of plantations have we lost since 1987 on the Klamath National Forest alone? I don't know the total, but it's a lot. A lot of them burn up. They're not going to stay there. Large trees. It's impossible to actually predict whether a tree that still has green foliage is going to die. There's all kinds of papers cited, and you can read them. But the bottom line is, scientifically, you can't predict it. And allowing big trees to be cut as part of a salvage operation is an invitation to abuses. And these temporary roads, the reason the earth flows are so important is because of the road building and the temporary roads. And a lot of those are on the earth flows because that's where the big trees that are being targeted grow. Thank you.
Thank you. Unless someone else has a pink slip, that's going to be the conclusion of public testimony. Does the Forest Service want to make a very brief response? But I don't want to get into, back and forth with our staff and back to the audience here. I want to have it brief. Thank you.
So Mr. Chairman and the board, certainly if you have any additional questions about some of the stuff that was presented today, we're happy to provide information on that. In general, the biggest thing I think that we all have to remember is these trees are dead. You have to remember back to my pictures up there. They're dead, and it's not a question of, we're going to gain additional root strength by leaving those in place up there, and of course, the stumps aren't coming out. the reforestation piece, you know, we've taken a look at the models, and yeah, we do get a 30-year jump on, you know, reestablishing root strength and the gains from landslide risk by going in there. You know, someone brought up the fact about planting under snags. You know, there are some serious safety implications around that kind of thing, but even more so, if you're interested in retaining that plantation, I hear a lot of that, they're retaining that plantation on the landscape, you're not going to plant under snags because you're basically going to create the worst case in 20 or 30 years for a fuels profile, because all those snags are going to be down, and you're going to, you know, and you're going to have young growth in there, and you know, you're not going to hang on to that plantation. So that's a few things in response. Dan?
Yeah. So we just delivered the hard copy of the final environmental impact statement to Tom. You know, I think about gave him a hernia to take it in there, but it's a three separate
volumes.
Documents, volumes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the best way of putting it. And the response to comments is double wide. It's 11 by 14. And so, you know, there's been a lot of comments here, and sort of, you know, it'd be difficult for us to address all that, you know, right here. But, you know, I did hear a couple of things. You know, one was comments on the ACS. You know, we do have a separate ACS report, aquatic conservation strategy report and stuff, and that's about 80 pages to address, you know, how we're addressing that, you know, that law. And also, you know, a lot of comments on, you know, reopening roads, those landings in riparian reserves. One thing that may not be really clear here is that, you know, as opposed to like a, you know, private ownership, you know, they tend to put in another road when they want to harvest in an area. You know, with this project, you know, the first thing we looked at is, you know, is there the potential to do some sort of helicopter logging instead of, you know, putting in a new road. And because of that, you know, we made that decision to not put in a road in quite a few options, and sometimes it was like even a decommissioned road that we were thinking of opening up, and we decided not to reopen those up in favor of moving towards helicopter logging, which of course is much more expensive and doesn't provide much in the way of returns. But you know, we're trying to, you know, reestablish you know, good forested condition out there. So, you know, because we did that, you know, we did have to add a few helicopter landings out on the landscape, but we felt those were much lower impacts than putting in a new road. So there's trade-offs here that aren't necessarily seen, you know, straight up. But, you know, I would, any questions that you have, you know, there's a huge document, and we're more than willing to help folks through with that, too.
Thank you. Any board questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Speaking of that huge document, so that the EIS is certified, is that correct?
It's been filed. Yes, it was filed with the Federal Register, our federal process, last Friday.
So, can I ask you then, if this project, how much latitude is there in EIS then to modify project before that thing becomes a modified project to the point where you have to modify the EIS as a result?
Well, there's a lot of art in that, so I don't think I can really give you, you know, a straight up standard. But I have to wait 30 days before I can issue a record of decision on that. And you know, we are in a review period right now. If people feel like there's additional information to consider, and certainly, you know, we 13,000 comments later, you know, we've considered a lot of information. But if there's anything that's additional out there, this is a period that people can bring that forward, and I'll consider that in making a decision.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Any other board comments? All right. Thank you.
Thank you. And we're happy to work with the staff in clearing up any other questions that may still exist.
We appreciate that. Maybe one last question. I know there's been a lot of negotiations back and forth with the Karuk tribe. What's your general sense of how those have gone?
I think that they've gone very well. In fact, you know, one of the things that we need to do in order to move this, a couple of things that we need to do in order to move the project forward is, of course, you know, meet our obligations under the Endangered Species Act with National Marine Fisheries Service. And not only has the NIMS biologist been out and our biologist has been out, but the Karuk tribe fish biologist has been out, and you know, they've worked together on minimizing effects out there with respect to the project. So we really appreciate that.
All right. Thank you.
You bet.
What I would like to throw out, and maybe staff wants to comment right now, but
The thing that I wanted to say was for those that have provided oral comments, we would appreciate getting comments in writing. So I'm going to ask that we have a 2-week deadline to receive written comments on the waiver application that was submitted. So 2 weeks from today.
And will staff have a chance to analyze, and are you going to file comments on the EIS? Within that 2 weeks?
So we have not discussed internally as to whether we were going to comment on the on the final EIS.
Do you believe you have the capacity within that timeline?
We can put our comments together in that time frame, yes. Okay.
So what I'd like to propose to the board is we take two steps. The first step is any last-minute comments or directions that we want to see. There can't be any votes because this is an informational session. And then take up separately board opinions on the process options we have and any thoughts board members have. Otherwise, it gets delegated to Matt and myself. So, and I'd prefer to get some board guidance. So first, let's off. What do, after having heard this, board members want to see of changes, if any? I'm trying to solicit board comments on what changes, if any, do you want to suggest to staff be considered on the Forest Service proposal?
I think suggestions might be too strong of a word, but some reaction.
Comments.
Yeah, some reaction to what I heard today. I can appreciate, one reaction I had was to a slide, Patty, that you showed, and we just had all these jackstraws of down logs on the ground, and I can appreciate thinking into the future and trying to manage fire risk. But through my career, I've done FSC, Forest Stewardship Council certification on different kinds of sanitation operations, and there's a role for woody debris. At some point, there's a threshold where you have too much and not enough, because even though you're going to go out and plant seedlings, those seedlings are at least a decade away from providing any sediment adhesion ability. So in the meantime, moderate and large woody debris will play a role in stopping above ground movement of sediment. So a cautionary note, we don't want to make it a moonscape, because those little trees just don't have the ability until they get much larger. And then also too, I want to stay within water quality parameters. Some of those areas that were shown in like this one image down here, I can appreciate that there's an immediate need to address, you know, some of the intensely burned riparian areas. I would hope that you would use things, maybe a set of conifers, but willow cuttings or something that can regenerate relatively quickly, just to get some cover on the ground, and finding what sources you have there. So, I think the important thing is to recognize, and I really like George Harper's comments and Mr. Durr's comments. I mean, we're all after the same thing. I really like that, and I want to keep that tone throughout this moving forward. It's a large project. It is intimidatingly large, but I think if we stay focused on what it is we're trying to do, keep soil in place, do it in a reasonable way, I think we can move forward. I'm not sure, and John or Samantha, waiver versus non-waiver. Initially, what I want to do is make sure that we address water quality concerns and don't do things in the riparian reserves that don't meet the objectives of the riparian reserves, and at the same time get cover on the ground to keep that sediment in place. So I guess what I'm saying is I don't have this absolute steadfast approach, but that's what I think we're trying to achieve in the long run.
Yeah, this is Samantha Olson, your counsel. I think staff would prefer to hear your substantive comments today rather than have a procedural discussion, because it's really the substance of the project and your concerns with it that would dictate any procedural discussion that would follow. So if we can stay focused on that, I'd appreciate it.
I may skate on thin ice on that when it comes time for my comments. Any other board member direction? Board Member Noor.
Mr. Chair, I see a progression here of correspondence and process that I think needs to continue, in my humble opinion. I think that I greatly appreciate a registered professional forester and some of the comments here today, all these comments today. It sounds like we have an EIS that's out for review. More comments are coming back. In talking to our staff and looking at this project through the lens of a waiver, I think part of the issue is that a Category B waiver was supposed to be a low-impact project, but this is all about scale, and it's about a catastrophic wildfire that really is quite big. I agree. I see a process, though, that is getting to the point where I see a progression of letters. The first one Tom Williams wrote in December 2014 was very, very good. A continuation of letters and response back from the U.S. Forest Service that I think is modifying project. I think you've taken the issue of water quality impacts and the waiver requirements seriously. At the same time, I got to admit I'm not a forester, but I do see, and I made a lot of notes just around the tables and numbers here. I look at the no project alternative where I see high likelihood of sediment production and I see a high likelihood of landslide. And at least in my reading of this, and again, I'm not a registered forester, but I see a lessening of that effect, and I hear that there's going to be a speeded recovery, though the impact to water quality here remains a concern. I mean, those types of pictures from a cloudburst that happened in July remain a concern here. Of course, we're about water quality, and how do we get there? Feeling is keep working towards this project as it is. That's why I asked the question on the EIS, how far can you further modify this project, hearing the concerns you had today, and not have to modify the EIS? My request is that you continue to work with our staff and our executive officer and come to resolution on this. That would be, and if that cannot happen, then I would further recommend that this board then takes the reins and we make some decisions on this. But we're going to have to know that rather fast, because I believe this project has at least some expectation of expediency. Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah,
Samantha again. I was hoping we could add to our request for the written comments in writing for those parties to address sort of the alternative. That would be really helpful, because we know we have this issue of if we do nothing, might be worse. So if you could address that area of concern, we'd appreciate it.
I just want to reaffirm both Board Member Norton and Council Olson's comments. I totally agree with them. I think what this does, however, is red flag. How are we going to deal with catastrophic fires? And I do think there is a good possibility of future catastrophic fires. And we're caught in a couple conundrums I want people to think about. One of them is you do have valuable timber, and it's not reasonable not to use it if it's good. There is a time frame that tends to be quite intense after a catastrophic fire. And what disturbs me is we're still dealing around with what our process is, and it's a lot of months into this, and we can't quite decide. I think we almost need to think through how we can handle internal decision-making on a catastrophic fire, whether it's to WDR, whether it's to within the waiver, whether it's within the waiver to the board. has a set of procedures that will work like clockwork and work very quickly. I don't want to put all the burden on us. I think the Forest Service took a little while to modify the project, and that put us in this spot. Right now, I'm leaning towards the status quo of a modified waiver, because I think to reset the wheel and go back to WDR, then we get certain negative effects that you can't undo through the time-consuming nature of that process. But I do think when we have fires 160 acres, that's beyond the scale originally imagined under the waiver, and we need a better regulatory format for that. So won't help us now. We are where we are. But I do want us to think through that process, because I truly believe we could have a – well, we got 60,000 acres burning right now, might grow. So we need a process that's clear to the Forest Service, clear to the board, clear to the public, how we can get expedited reviews on these really serious matters. It is quite challenging because aside from the scale, every fire is an opportunity to do everything you want to do 20 years and haven't been able to do, and we need to avoid that. And yet, at the same time, we have to find a really timely way of acting for the future. And it's touchy with fires. They're hard to predict. But I think we need to bite the bullet and really think that through, and that may affect our earlier study session on that waiver of us looking at an expedited process for fires, whatever it is, for large fires, I think is needed. So those are my comments. I hope is that clear. Okay. And then I do encourage the parties to keep working together. A lot of progress has been made. There's a lot of interests involved. They don't all add up, and I understand someone's going to be unhappy, but we need to take the best balance we can do as human beings and act in a reasonably timely fashion.
Can I make one comment and ask for a clarification? So the comment is just to be that we're asking for written comments from interested parties on the waiver application that's been submitted by close of business on August 26th. The clarification is in your question to me, Chairman Corbett, you asked whether we staff were intending to comment on the final EIS, and my response was not sure how to answer it because it is a final EIS. So it is a final document that's being I don't think they're asking for comments on the final EIS. What I'd prefer that we comment on is on the waiver application. That's what you're asking for, I think, is that staff commit to a time frame in which we complete our assessment.
I think that better states my position
and
the way I stated it. My concern was I wanted to make sure that our staff had time to adequately reply to any replies we felt we had to do.
Perfect.
I think you've answered that question.
Perfect. Yes. Thank you.
Anything else? Okay. I think that closes the study session. Because it is an informational item, everyone gets another bite at the apple. A lot of the testimony is really high quality. It's very technical. It's not like, just to be truthful, I'd have to go and get a letter and I'd have to go look it up to totally follow it and give the respect due. So I would encourage all the sites to get it to staff and then give a CC to the executive director that he can give to us as well, so we can really bore down on this. Yeah.
Susan Corm with Creek Tribe. Could I request official government-to-government consultation between your staff and the Creek Tribe before you adopt the waiver, if there's a modified waiver?
So you mean another government-to-government consultation
in regards to
West Side?
Yes,
we can definitely do that.
And
I do want to say there's a weakness right now in California. The Water Board hasn't totally defined that process. But that's what the federal government does, and I strongly encourage we follow that till we're directed otherwise.
And we have a consultation policy which we've shared with your staff, which we would prefer to use over anything that the federal or state agency adopts anyways.
All right.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the next is an update on the development of the total maximum